Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
Hi, how are you? My name is Andrew WK. They say when things are very delicious, it must be Heritage Radio.
We talk about food. About music with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz.
And I'm the other half, Darren Bresnitz.
Welcome. That was just welcome. Michael Daves, who will be live in studio. We weren't sure which version we were going to get, the bluegrass or the rock and roll version, but I'm quite happy that we're going to have the bluegrass version in later today. But first off, Tracy and Josh from Kings County Imperial, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys.
We are doing our ninth annual kickoff barbecue blowout with you on Tuesday, which we're very excited about, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But first and foremost, we're going to talk about the important issues here. Who is the better fisher of the two of you?
Ooh, salt or freshwater?
I don't know.
I'd say... I'd say Josh gets the saltwater nod, and I probably get the freshwater nod.
Yeah, she goes for the I go for the surf casting, and she goes for the fly line.
What's the largest fish you ever hauled in?
Me?
Yeah.
The most impressive fish I ever hauled in was a 19-pound bluefish, but it wasn't the biggest. But for a bluefish, and I was 12 years old, so that made it even more impressive.
I mean, you won an award when you were like 15 about this.
Oh yeah, you know, I'm world famous for my fishing angling skills.
No, but I mean, I feel like I mean, that has to be a world that like you have you know, that has paid off those skills, you know, as life as a chef.
Well, for sure. I mean, it's one of my favorite things to cook is fish. So
and for both of you, it is rare that two partners have, like, I mean, if you had various hobbies, be fine, but to both be you know, accomplished in albeit different types of bodies of water, it's interesting that you two found that commonality.
Well, Tracy used to spend 180 days a year in the woods, so she sort of had no choice but to find that interest.
Why 180? Why so specific?
You know, Greg, I used to teach outdoor education for an organization called NOLS, the National Outdoor Leadership School, and we'd lead 32-day trips into the remote wilderness of North America and really around the world. So we'd spent a lot of time pursuing outdoor endeavors, as you can imagine, and fly fishing was one of those. So I spent a lot of time alpine fly fishing in the wilderness of Alaska and Wyoming. And
Have you two been able to trade secrets or tips based on your various fly fishing experiences?
Have we actually ever gone fishing together?
Yeah, we fish in Wyoming together.
right. We do.
You guys go down to the East River, right? Hauling a couple of
exactly, right.
That's our
four-headed
secret
fish.
That's our secret for low food costs.
That's the secret one.
We pull everything out of the Gowanus.
We might have to put that on tap for the summer to take a fishing trip somewhere.
I mean, a little busy, but I mean, it seems like, you know, it would be worth the trip. And then and I mean, among the million accolades, also Tracy, you have awards from the yacht world.
Oh. Yeah,
which is that, like, I mean, this is an award-winning show, you know, I'm just saying, but to have two illustrious things, I mean, it's pretty incredible. Can you talk just a little bit about your yacht past?
Sure.
Because when I look at you, I think that's someone who spent a lot of time on a yacht.
Yeah, right. I have that look about me. It feels like a different life. It really does. I spent about 9 years as a private chef on the super yachts, which you honestly couldn't get any more extreme from going from the wilderness of Wyoming to the super, flashy lifestyle of the super yachts. But yeah, I worked as a private chef on very large boats for a good number of years in the Mediterranean, the Caribbean, and I have a lot of stories. We'll have to talk about it over a beer sometime.
One story.
Yeah, like
one
half
story.
A story.
Come on. Wildest food request.
Wildest food request. I was working for a family of exiled Kyrgyzstani royalty. They had,
as one does.
As you do on the super yachts, they had rented or chartered, it's called, a 220-foot super yacht. And we were in the remote areas of the West Indies. And, you know, everything is brought on board beforehand because you spend a lot of time out at sea. Anyway, I had a request one night for Domino's Pizza. And I mean, honestly, like, there probably wasn't a Domino's pizza within 10,000 miles. And I sent back a message with the stewardesses and I said, well, that's not possible this evening, but I'd be more than happy to make homemade pizza. No, they wanted Domino's pizza. Anyway, through a lot of back and forth with the captain and with the stewardess, we finally got the message across that there wasn't going to be any Domino's pizza, but that was very...
Oh, wait, Domino's doesn't have that, like, helicopter that just drops?
Domino's.
Yeah, that's what they wanted.
You should have just rustled up a Domino's box.
Right. Anyway.
Well, I mean, it'd be great to also, like, you know, just kind of talk about, like, where you two began to cross paths, because you two, we could easily spend a show on each of you because you have such amazing backgrounds. But, like, let's start with, like, the shared history of where you first kind of crossed knives, if you will.
Well, ironically, we met at a Chinese restaurant. I was a sous chef at a restaurant called The Single Pebble in, mid-northern Vermont. And we both went to culinary school at New England Culinary Institute. And Tracy came on board because she liked the process of making Peking ducks. She was very, when she came in for her interview, she was struck by the ducks, by the hanging ducks in the kitchen. And that was our first culinary, where we first met there, and that was our first culinary interaction as well.
What is your, like, the secret to a good, making good Peking duck?
Well, strangely, we actually don't make it because it is...
No, I know it's not on the menu, but I'm just saying.
It's like a two-day process.
Well,
it's... really do it.
It's marinating, it's separating the skin from the flesh, and it's the wood, the fruit wood that's used
in
the process.
So you have to have a duck that has all of its parts intact, so it has to have its feet on, its head on, because when you blow the duck up, you can do it with a simple bicycle pump if you wanted to do one duck. You sort of pierce a hole in the skin towards its neck and you blow air into it. And the skin actually separates from the flesh so that when you hang it, that fat theoretically drips down while it's cooking and you get really crispy skin and really moist flesh. And you don't get like a thick layer of fat, as we all know duck has a lot of fat.
You know, I have to respect the fact that, and this sort of goes into your history and your approach to the restaurant, that you know what it takes to do it, you know the process, and you're saying, if we can't do it right, we're not going to do it. We're going to focus on doing other things right.
Well, yeah, and it's, like you said, it's a two-day process, so it's a very sort of, you know, like, on-demand type of thing. When I was growing up, like, a lot of the great Peking duck restaurants in New York, you know, you had to order your duck 24 hours in advance. So, you know, we've toyed around with that idea, but right now we're just focused on making, doing what we have as well as we can.
So from Vermont, where did you two go next?
From Vermont, gosh, I'm trying to think. I think I went to New Zealand for a little while.
We traveled in China for a long time.
That's right, that's
right. And throughout Southeast Asia.
Which is crazy. And you cooked on one of the trains, right?
Yeah, well, we took the train. Basically, it was the Mongolian Railway, except it was on the China side.
Right.
So it wasn't like one long, continuous journey. It was like lots of little hops.
Yeah.
And we found some of the food on the trains, even though we couldn't really read the menus, couldn't communicate with the staff. We found the food to be unbelievably good.
That was like prepared on the train.
It was prepared on the trains. They had woks on the trains. They had chefs on the trains. I mean, it wasn't like imperial cuisine, but it was really good home-cooked Chinese. And so one day we were just like, you know, through sign language and other ways you communicate when you're in a foreign country, We just muscled our way into the kitchen and had them show us some stuff, and we cooked on the train all the way from basically from Beijing to
I think it was a 78-hour train trip. So we spent a lot of time in the dining car, and they sort of, we were the only Westerners, or the only Westerners that I saw. It was a long train, I don't know, 20, 25 cars. But anyway, we spent a lot of time in the dining car, and they found us to be very interesting and intriguing. So
did they, I mean 78 hours, like, that's a long train ride, but that's like not a ton of time to earn, like, you know, the trust to get into the kitchen. So, like, you know, did they let you cook things? Did they show you stuff? Like, did they let you, like, how did,
you well know? Once we find that sort of the litmus test is once you show people in the culinary world that you know how to use a knife, they sort of let you into their club.
Okay.
So it's like, you know, they look at you like you've got three heads at first, and you're like, why do you want to be in this kitchen? And then when you show them that you have some skills, then they sort of lighten up a little bit and ease up.
And what was the setup like? Was it just, you know, was it like, did they use coal or the gas? I mean, like, what are you cooking on?
Well, they were cooking on gas, but they had coal-fired, these huge coal-fired tea urns that were every four or five cars. It was really cool, and it was a very, you know, very vintage antique, you know, I don't know that, I'm not up on my train models, but it you know, it's probably 100 years old, that train, but the kitchen was traditional woks fired with gas and
small, but
yeah,
like, small,
yeah.
But like kind of like a galley, right?
A little bit like a galley. The chefs were all dressed with their, you know, pristine white coats, and they took their jobs absolutely with great pride. And I think at first they just thought it was sort of funny that we were interested in the food. I mean, we literally didn't know what anything was on the menu, and we'd wait for other diners to come in and see what they order, and we'd just point at things. You know, they serve warm beer called Piju on the train. There was no cold beer, and we spent a lot of time drinking warm beer and eating some great food on those trains. And yeah, they took a shine to us, and then eventually, yeah, they let us hang out with them and help do a little, you know, this and that. Would have been great if it was 3 months longer, the train trip, but we have good memories.
Did you take any of those dishes from that trip and that experience and bring them to the restaurant?
Well, I mean, our philosophy about the restaurant is like we've taken. Some people think it's a mishmash of different, you know, regions of China. We take just our favorite dishes. So I can't remember anything specifically from the train, but like definitely, you know, like the twice cooked pork kind of idea. Like if we had it like the best version we ever had on the train, then that's the one we kind of tried to replicate.
Emulate, yeah.
That's amazing.
And then obviously some years passed. So like what kind of began the impetus for Kings County?
Well, we've always had the dream. I mean, ever since we worked in this Chinese restaurant, which was sort of a queer situation because it's in Vermont and it's run by, you know, an Anglo guy who's really loves Chinese culture and cuisine, but has sort of devoted his life to it. We just thought, wow, this is something that's really great, really interesting. I've had a lifelong love of Chinese food growing up in New York. Tracy has her own stories from Philly, but we've always wanted to do it. It's just always been a passion. So our first restaurant in New York was Stone Park, and at that time, I remember we had a debate. Do we want to go Chinese? Do we want to go contemporary American? And we just sort of felt a little insecure about going out on a limb at that time, but the second time around, we said, "You know what? We got to do this Chinese thing because we'll never live with ourselves if we don't try it now."
I mean, I have to say that, you know, for years we were scratching our heads at why we couldn't have a Chinese restaurant like the one that you've opened in, you know, this part of Brooklyn. So right. I think I thank you on part of everyone else for opening
thanks,
up, and following in on that dream.
Well,
because so many times you had to just like go to a different part of the city, which is fine. But on a cold Sunday night, you're like, can we just go somewhere close?
I mean, I was in Chinatown this morning, and I live up in Greenpoint, and just getting down to Chinatown on the weekend, like, it's, like, not, like, terrible, but it's also not the easiest or most convenient way to do it. What is it, like, I mean, was there one kind of dish or a couple dishes that, like, you know, it's like, you know, these are the dishes that we're going to build the rest of the menu around, or these, since it's, like, it is a compendium of your favorite dishes?
Well, there's two sort of central themes, I think, in our restaurant, even though they're wildly divergent. We both love dim sum. We both love dumplings.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one super focus that we
yeah,
you know,
those
we
long dumplings are
yeah, we hand make everything. We like roll it out. We try to do it with as much integrity as possible. And then the other thing we like is I personally like really strong, bold flavors. So we sort of stick with, and I know this is like, you know, a gross generalization, but middle China and, you know, stronger flavors with Sichuan peppercorn, a little bit of heat, like some pickled stuff in there. So those are two things that, you know, might be considered fusion from a Chinese perspective, but because we're bouncing back between different regions in China, but those are the two that we really focus on and love.
Amazing. We're going to take a quick musical break with a previous live performance from the band Suckers, and then we're going to be right back and we're going to talk about soy sauce.
Sounds good. We'll be here.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Fever has broken five fingers that life wise. Like pulling out my hair, playing truth or dare. Well, that's a pretty little get up you got on tonight. I'd like to see you around your ankles while we're scratching by.
On Tuesday, May 17th, please join Snacky Tunes for the 9th Annual Barbecue Blowout. Our inaugural chefs are Kings County Imperial with Beats and Rhythms by Domino Records. Tickets are $10 in advance at BBQ Blowout, May2016.eventbrite.com. Tickets include a plate of food and a complimentary Brooklyn Brewery. We're happy to announce returning partners of Nikki Digital and Heritage Radio Network. We hope to see you there.
All right, welcome back.
Welcome back. That was such a good show. Those guys are some of the best. So in putting your menu together for Kings County Imperial, how did you, I mean, first off, it's incredible, and I always have trouble picking 10 dishes that I want because I want it all, but how did you curate it? Like, what made the cut, what didn't make the cut, and what was the reasoning behind the items that went on the menu?
Very good question.
You know, because we hadn't cooked Chinese in quite some time. I mean, to really do it right, you need woks and you need a whole lot of things that aren't easily available in a normal sort of Western style kitchen.
It's like learning another language.
And we hadn't done it for a while. So when we had a custom made 6-hole wok stove built by one of our partners who is Chinese, Chef George Wong, who's been absolutely invaluable resource for us. He had a custom-built wok stove brought in, and it took us months to really get to where we wanted to be with that stove. So we cooked and cooked and cooked for friends, for family, for anybody that we could get to come through that door.
It was
a lot of trial. Well, I don't know if they'd say that, but there's some severe misfires. But that's how we got to where we are. We just cooked and got a lot of feedback and ate as much as we could and got to where we thought we had the base.
But also, like a lot of Chinese food is, like a lot of Chinese restaurants have very massive menus, and that's because it's all in the mise en place. Like everything is prepared beforehand, and when you have 120,000 BTU wok, that food is cooking like you cook. Each dish takes less than a minute to cook. It's all chopped and fired beforehand, and then you just, you know, it hits the wok and bam, it's on the plate. And you know, we wanted to just give a representation of all of our favorite things. So like crispy garlic chicken, we went down to, you know, we love this restaurant in Marlton, Pennsylvania that has the best crispy garlic chicken we've ever had. And it's on every, you know, Chinese restaurant menu, you know, most in America. and this was the best. So Tracy went down there and cooked in their kitchen for 2 weeks, and we sort of, you know, figured out how they do it and then replicated that. And we did that dish by dish with all of our favorite things, which is why the menu, from a regionality standpoint, is a bit of a mishmash.
That's fine.
Oh, it's great.
You know, it's like a greatest hit. You're like your personal collection of favorite dishes. Now, if for anyone who's coming in, you know, what would you recommend to take them through? Like, what is your one or two signature dishes, and why? Like, how does that represent like the reason, the thesis behind the restaurant?
Well, I mean, like, Chinese food is all about balance, and most Southeast Asian cuisines are all about balance. And I don't know, I guess you could argue all food is about balance, but it's really important in Chinese when you're doing a Chinese menu or you're, you know, ordering for a table, to get kind of like different things, like some crispy things, some spicy things, some things that cool the palate if you're going to get some spicy things, some, you know, you're marrying different textures and flavors and colors and all the, you know, different proteins and vegetables all on the table rather than, you know, on a single plate. So, you know, we work hard to train our waiters to kind of like guide people through the experience who aren't familiar with it, or, you know, just to kind of suggest stuff and, you know, bounce ideas back and forth. Like, you have a noodle dish, you might want to try this, or, you know, like that. So it's really all about balancing the different dishes.
And the makgeo.
And the makgeo.
And the makgeo, all that and the makgeo.
And the makgeo.
And also, like, let's not forget, like, the accoutrement, if you will, and your soy sauce, which I think is really incredible. And the fact that you are making your own, it's on tap, which I've never heard of before. Tell us like a bit about the history of that and like how you met the family that makes it for you.
Well, we did quite a bit of research that didn't really produce too many results for a few years. And then I ended up stumbling upon a blog of an English guy that spent a couple years traveling through China and Southeast Asia. And he had visited the soy fermentation fields of this family. And he had explained it, and he had named the family. And I ended up contacting them to no avail. And I ended up getting a voice message probably 2 or 3 months later, all in Chinese. Anyway, so began the relationship that we have. We ended up traveling over to southern China, where it's a third generation family of soy makers. They make it in fairly large quantities. They sun ferment their soy still. I mean, a lot of China has gone to sort of an artificially stimulated, chemically sort of induced heating process for soy, which takes about 2 days to produce soy. This family still ferments their soy from anywhere from 6 months up to 2 or 3 years. Anyway, we build a relationship with them. We've been back multiple times. We have soy that's in porcelain vats right now out in the sun along the Pearl River Delta, and we're getting ready for our first large shipment. We've had smaller shipments come over, which we do have on tap. We use it in all of our cooking, but our first big shipment, we're just figuring out bottling and labeling, and we're taking the leap
to build that relationship. Like, I mean, how did that, you know, how did that go? I mean, besides culture, like, was the same thing, like, you had to show them knife skills and they're like, all right, we'll give you soy sauce? Like, were you on the train, or like, how did that trust, or how did that relationship kind of grow?
They actually are very organized. They have a showroom where they have soy that they we're not the only ones that they have this relationship with. They make soy for you know, for other entities all over the world, in Taiwan and in Europe and Southeast Asia, all small batch. But so they welcomed us wholeheartedly, with, you know, very graciously, with open arms.
But we were very specific about what, you know, about the recipe we wanted. So we had a lot of trial and error.
Yes, that's
figuring
true.
Out, you know, exactly what we wanted in it. We didn't want, you know, sodium benzoate or other preservatives. We wanted to have a certain flavor profile that we were looking for. And so there was and still is a lot of back and forth between us.
It's amazing. Now, we're super excited about you guys agreeing to kick off our knife season of the barbecue. And, you know, barbecue and smoking meats and things like that has long been a tradition in Chinese cooking. And we want to talk to you about the menu and your approach to doing something that's like a grilling outside type of event.
Well, yeah, well, we got, right as we speak, we got, I think, 80 racks of ribs hanging in our, and we call it, we call it a duck oven. We hang them just just like you do with the ducks or pork. And they marinate for 3 days, these ribs. They're slow roasted, hanging for hours. We baste them every 15 minutes. We're psyched.
We're really excited. It's been absolute torture the last few days at the restaurant because there's these racks and racks of ribs everywhere and everybody wants to eat them. And Josh is like, no, that's for the barbecue. Hands off.
So we're in the tradition of balance, we're doing the ribs, we're doing our cold sesame noodle, and we're doing our spicy Sichuan cucumber salad. So that's going to be the plate for the barbecue,
which we can't wait for. And I wish you had just kind of brought like a preview here.
We should have.
I know, but we'll just we'll eat our weight in it. So we want to thank you for coming by.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, of course. We're super excited for Tuesday. Where can people find you online, social media, physical address?
Yep, we're at kingscoimperial.com on Facebook, Instagram, website, or just better yet, come by 20 Skillman Avenue in Williamsburg between Meeker and Larimer.
And now you're doing brunch.
Now we're doing Sunday dim sum.
Oh my gosh. Okay. It's not Chinatown, but it's so much closer. I'm very excited.
How is the brunch crowd? Because I know that the Brooklyn brunch crowd, if they take into the Chinese type of cuisine.
You know, it's a slow burn. I think Greg had that.
We haven't advertised or put it out there. Like, this is sort of the first public announcement we've ever made about the dim sum brunch. But we don't do carts like traditional, you know, dim sum places because we found out early on that they don't really work with a concrete floor. So everything's fresh made to order, but we have, you know, many traditional dim sum items, radish cake, shomai, different kinds of dumplings,
and we got
salads, noodles.
And our King's Mary, which is our take on our Bloody Mary with a little bit of house soy and some Sichuan peppercorn salt in it. So, yeah, that's our little nod to the traditional brunch scene.
Sold. Well, thank you for
booze and dumplings. I don't see how you could go wrong.
Come on by next Sunday.
Thanks for coming by. We have Michael Daves up live in studio, but we have one of our all-time favorites from She Keeps Bees. Live from Snacking Tunes. We will be right back.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Don't you tell them what to do. Just sit yourself down. And don't do these things to you. The knuckle, baby, look me dead in the eye. Watch you see right through me too.
Tambo solo. So good. Yeah.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
All right. Michael and crew, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Hey there.
You want to go around the room and introduce yourselves?
Sure, absolutely. Here we got, on the mandolin, we got Dominic Leslie and Jen Larson. She's going to be singing here with me. And on the bass, Larry Cook.
Welcome. From across the room. I mean, across the trailer.
Glad to be here.
I'm so excited you're here because the record you just put out is such an amazing concept that, like, I think people kind of, like, dream about that an artist would do, but you actually did it. For those of you who don't know, it's called Orchids and Violence on Nonesuch, which is equally just, like, one of the best labels that's ever existed in the history of labels.
I agree, yeah.
Just if you are into, like, music that is just good across all type of genres, just like just go listen to everything they've ever done.
They've got a pretty amazing output over the last 50 years or so.
It's pretty incredible. But what you've done, and just to for the people who are not prepared for this episode, you took pretty much the same song and did it twice.
Yeah, it's the same 12 songs. It started with 12 mostly traditional songs, or you know, like old time and bluegrass and old murder ballads and whatnot, and I did the same track list on two discs. So the first disc is like straight ahead bluegrass, which is pretty much what we're going to be playing today. And the second disc, I did the same songs in the same order, but it's kind of an experimental electric album. So reinterpreted them kind of from the ground up in some cases.
And I'm sure that you'll probably get this question asked you through all the interviews, but like, where did this come from and why did you feel the desire to do this?
Well, I came out of bluegrass music. That's something I grew up with. So my parents played fiddle and banjo, so it was in the household growing up. And it's always just been a part of who I am as personally and musically, and something I've really gravitated back to, especially in the last 10 years of my life or so. I just really end up doing primarily bluegrass music. But, along the way, it definitely gotten way into other forms of music, experimental music, jazz, noise rock, mm-hmm. All these, different influences are also part of me. And, so when I wanted to record an album and was trying to figure out what sort of album I wanted to do. And I knew I wanted to do something that really kind of hung together as a piece. I didn't want to just kind of record a collection of tunes and kind of have it be a bunch of singles. So, and I didn't want to do sort of a mishmash of too many influences. I wanted it to be kind of about one thing. But then I couldn't really figure out whether to kind of do the traditional bluegrass thing, which has really been a big part of what I've done in the last 10 years, or express some of these kind of more experimental ideas. And so this was a solution. This double album concept was kind of...
Someone called a solution. Someone called, like, masochistic.
Yeah, it was an opportunity to take these old songs, which, many of which have been around for hundreds of years, who knows how long. Some of these old murder ballads are really hundreds of years old and have had a lot of life, even before bluegrass music was a thing. And, so they just, they get performed in the style of whoever's performing them, whether it's, 1750 or 1900 or 1950 or now, and everyone just kind of brings their own experience to it. So it was just kind of taking part of the process of people have for years, hundreds of years, continually reworked these songs. So just getting to explore them in very much in the bluegrass tradition, which I love and primarily work in, with a band of musicians that I just really wanted to get together in a room, but then also, take those same songs.
Do you find that every time you explore a song or re-explore it, it extends its life and gives it a new lease on it?
Well, I believe that's what these songs are meant for. These songs have been around for hundreds of years. They're enduring because they have a way of they are sort of a template or a container for the experience and the emotions of whoever's singing them. And so, you know, everyone who sings these songs, it's a folk tradition, and so everyone sort of brings their own perspective to it. And, you know, these are two musical perspectives that I was able to present on this recording. You know, the bluegrass and the sort of more experimental side, which also gave me an opportunity to kind of explore the contrasts and versions and kind of the puzzle for me to solve.
Which I think we definitely want to address, but because you said it twice, murder ballads. What makes a good murder ballad for the uninitiated?
Oh, man. Well, there's so many murder ballads to choose from. And
is that like a canon? I mean, is that
it's
a canon?
Yeah,
of music?
It's a genre. Yeah, absolutely. There's a bunch of great ones. You know, I recorded Pretty Polly on these albums. You know, The Knoxville Girl, Omi Wise. You know, Banks of the Ohio. It goes on and on. There are so many of them that are done to this day, and they're all so brutal.
And I think what makes a really good like a torch song, like. You know, you hear a guitar and you're like, damn, that's really good. They really love that person. Like, what makes, like, a good murder ballad?
Well, it's you know, it's got to be gruesome and brutal. I mean, I think people
right.
sort of need that artistic engagement with, you know, with death, with violence, with brutality. You know, we have that in you know, in horror movies and action movies, you know, and it's, I think it's important for people to kind of get to engage in that in a song, you know, rather than in real life experience.
Okay, I just got threatened on the radio. You all heard this.
Well, you know, that's why we have these songs. You know, yeah. they're songs that just express, you know, all aspects of human experience and
yeah.
and. You know, and so in these singing these songs and hearing these songs, you feel this kind of pathos for the victim, and you want the perpetrator to be brought to justice. And you know, one of my favorite ones, "Knoxville Girl," which was most famously recorded by the Lubin Brothers. I mean, part of is that they record that song in such a kind of upbeat manner. They're like, I met a little girl in Knoxville. And it's very, it's almost kind of like upbeat and happy sounding, like they're at a party or something, but it's this gruesome murder, and that sort of makes it all the more twisted.
Right.
That it's, you know. I've also, there's a great recording of Nick Cave singing Knoxville Girl, which is totally the other way.
Oh,
he's
man.
Like, he seems way into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's what you
he's
want.
Like, he's like, wish I was there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can we hear, what are you going to play for us first?
Sure. Well, this is not a murder ballad.
No,
at
okay.
All.
No.
Actually, this is, after all this talk about old songs, we're actually going to lead off with the song that I recorded. This is the one song on the record that's not an old traditional number. It's actually by a Seattle band called Mother Love Bone, a proto-grunge
yeah.
band who I really love.
Yeah, they're wonderful.
Yeah, they're awesome. Yeah, and they broke up some of their members, went on to form Pearl Jam and other bands. Anyways, but I thought this would make a good bluegrass song.
Okay.
It's called Stargazer.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Let's do it.
No murders.
No murders.
With me. crusader and the prophet, sir.
So what, when you were writing this, like, what came first, the bluegrass song or the rock version?
Well, I mean, this. I'm sorry, when I was arranging it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, more than that, like, when you were putting the two kind of, like, records together, did you do all the bluegrass versions first, or did you do a bluegrass one, and then you did the rock version of that? Like, how did that come
yeah,
to be?
Well, the electric versions kind of started out maybe about 8 years ago. I had kind of come up with a batch of arrangements. I was at the time playing drums and guitar and singing at the same time. Mm. So sitting down, and my wife was playing bass. So we had kind of arranged, maybe about six or seven old bluegrass songs for that format. And that was sort of the seed of the electric record. And I knew what direction I wanted to take that in for the recording. To some degree, and then I picked the songs that were going to go on each album, and since we recorded the bluegrass record first, so those got finished and arranged first, and then of course once that was set and I knew what that was going to sound like, then this idea continued to evolve as far as how to arrange the electric stuff, because it was sort of a puzzle and a project of kind of getting each album to flow differently and really have its own identity that would stand alone, without needing the other album. Mm-hmm. But making sure each song, was different. And, if you did listen to them side by side, there would be some interesting contrast there.
Awesome. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in the recording process for the two albums? And your approach to each one.
Sure. Yeah. The recording process was really different for the bluegrass record. We did it all live in a big room over 3 days. Recorded a tape in the Old First Church in Brooklyn. They have an upper hall there, which is amazing sounding for acoustic music. And so we did it with four microphones, four tracks, and just got everyone there playing together, leading into the other mics and just kind of recording the sound of the room. So the concept was, it was kind of a recorded event. Mm. We didn't really do any overdubs or edits, or we did a few edits, but it was basically a live event. And then
for those who can't see in the room here, they're all just standing around one mic. This, like, I feel like we just went back to like how radio used to happen with you guys. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, a lot of bluegrass bands will perform, like the whole band will perform around a single condenser mic.
Yeah, I feel blessed.
We prefer it.
Yeah.
Anyways, but the electric record was done over about 3 months in my, I did most of it in my home studio and, some of it in other rooms. And, I played most of the instruments myself. I had my wife, Jessie Carter, played bass on it, and we had a cameo in one song by Tony Trischka on the banjo. But everything else I just tracked myself, so it was not at all done live. It was a layered studio creation, and that was kind of part of the concept there, and kind of creating the contrast is to have the recording processes being very different.
I mean, 3 days versus 3 months,
That's, yeah.
a bit of a difference. And for people who are listening to them side by side, you don't need to give away all the secrets, but is there, anything or any, particular pairing of tracks that you would point out that you, were happy or surprised by, how they sounded side by side?
Well, maybe it's a good time to bring up the vinyl release. It just came out last week. The double CD, which came out at the end of February, is called Orchids and Violence, and then we just released a vinyl edition called Violence and Orchids. And the difference is that it's just, the vinyl edition is just one disc, and it takes five songs, five each from the bluegrass and the electric discs, and then kind of interleaves them. So you get the bluegrass version of June Apple, the electric version of June Apple, and there's a whole sequence that's kind of designed to sort of highlight the contrast between the tracks. So I would encourage you to check that out and decide for yourself.
and which one is which? Which is the bluegrass and which is the electric? Is it orcas? Which one's orcas? Which one's violence?
I won't commit. The whole thing is just called Orcas and Violence. Okay. You can think of that what you will.
Maybe while we're like doing a murder ballad, I'll get you to tell me. do you want to play another one for us?
Sure. I'm going to do a song while Larry on bass. We're going to give you a little break. You can go have some whiskey and pizza. But Jen Larson and I are going to sing this as a duet, and with Dominic on the mandolin. Recorded this one on the record. Did as a duet with Sarah Jarosz. Mm-hmm. And it's written by Whit Khanna, who's he and his wife Barbara down in Atlanta are my musical godparents. So I'm sending this out to Whit and Barbara. Whit's song called Dark Angel. It's not a murder ballad, but there is death.
We're getting there.
Involved.
Yeah, we're getting there. We're getting close.
Yeah, we got three songs today. So it's called Dark Angel.
Records out, vinyls out.
Yes.
You had some release shows.
Yes.
What comes this summer?
Well, actually, there's one more release show. We're having a vinyl release show this Thursday in Brooklyn at Littlefield, which is in Gowanus on DeGrasse Street. And so that's going to feature both the electric band and the bluegrass band.
I was going to ask, like, how does the live... Obviously, we get the bluegrass, but how do the live shows work? And how does like the set list work too?
well, for the CD release shows we did in New York back in March, yeah, it was the same as what we're doing this Thursday, which is the, have the bluegrass band play in the first set and the electric band play in the second set. Mm. For this since this is the vinyl release show, each band is going to start out playing the five songs that are on the vinyl release.
Oh wow!
So at the beginning of each set, you'll get to hear the contrasting versions of those songs.
That's incredible. You're obviously doing double duty, but is anybody else wearing two hats or just two basses?
Well, on this Thursday on playing banjo with me is Tony Trischka, who's legendary banjo player. So really lucky to have him. And Tony is the only musician other than myself who played on both discs. Mm. He played on one song on each disc, and so we're gonna do that song. Darling Corey, which actually we're going to close with today, but you'll hear Tony playing on the bluegrass and on the electric versions. But other than that, the band is different.
And then are you able to take both out on the road, or do you have to pick
one side?
No, it's not really road material there to travel with two bands. I'm playing with the bluegrass band. We're doing Rocky Grass Festival out in Colorado.
Oh, great.
Bluegrass Festival. And I'm doing a trio tour in June, June 9th, 10th, and 11th, with Noam Bikilny on banjo and Brittany Haas on fiddle, who both played on the record. So that'll be the bluegrass sides. We're playing World Cafe in Philadelphia, Cafe 939 in Boston, and the Parlor Room in Northampton, Mass. That's going on the road. And the electric band, which is now called Wax Lion, we're doing mostly New York shows. And that's with Jesse Carter on bass and Kid Millions on drums, who plays stuff. Oneida and with Laurie Anderson and many other musicians. He's incredible, and so it's been a total joy working with him. If I had known him, I would have gotten him to play on the record. I actually played drums myself on the record, and then started working with Kid Millions on for the release shows, and that it's hopefully gonna kind of be an ongoing project under the name Wax Lion.
Before we have one more song, kind of final question is, from really diving in and approaching these songs in like two very different ways, did it give you like any deeper appreciation either for the way the songs are constructed or the subject of the songs themselves?
Well, these songs are very malleable, and to me, it's a way of honoring the songs, to show that they work in different ways. Some bluegrass purists might be offended that I'm adding, fuzz pedals and a bunch of weird stuff on the second record, but I would argue that it's actually out of deep respect of the songs and of the tradition of these songs, to do them two ways. And so some of them are about something specific like a murder or whatever, but a lot of these old songs are not really necessarily about anything in particular, or they don't need to be. And so I think they're made, what I think it shows me is that they're made to just kind of, for each performer to kind of put their own, experience into it. And I think that's why they're around for hundreds of years, and, some of them will probably still be around 100 years from now. People will be doing all sorts of different weird things with them, I hope.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming.
Thank you for all of us.
Where can people find you, get the record, sign up for tour dates, all the good stuff?
Yep, well, you can get all that information at my website, michaeldaves.com, DAVES. You can get the vinyl and the CD through Nonesuch Records website, Amazon, iTunes, all that stuff. Can't get the vinyl from iTunes. That's I think what we like about vinyl.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, but
the one trick. We want to thank you for coming by. Thank you to Tracy and Josh from Kings County Imperial. Please come to the barbecue on Tuesday. Shout out to Mom, Dad, Ornella, and the whole new Meatball Ace family and Bresnitz.
Shout out to Meatball. Shout out to Ahana. Shout out to the West Coast.
Okay.
Hello, West Coast. Yeah, I give up again for Dominic Leslie on the mandolin. Yeah. Jen Larson singing with me and Larry Cook on bass. Great to get to work with these guys.
Yeah, thank you for coming by. What are you going to take us out with?
Darling Corey.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have a good rest of the week.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.